Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 12 of the Wicker Man podcast, where every week myself and a different guest go through the 1973 cult horror classic The Wicker Man, one section at a time. I am joined on this week's episode by Niall McGowan. Niall, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. Thank you very much. I'm dying to get into... I was trying to remember what the lyrics are. Like oil, it's not oil rigs and barley rigs.
Yeah, corn rigs and barley rigs.
Corn rigs, there you go. That makes more sense. Yeah, somewhere also has an oil drilling company just down the road.
Yeah, no, that's local. That's Local Hero. It's not really well known that Local Hero is a spin-off of The Wicker Man, but...
I'll buy it, but why not? Yeah. Well, like, actually, the deleted ending of Burt Lancaster also getting burnt alive by the... got lured there by the people, was really charmed by the town, and they're like, we're still turning on you, we don't care, man.
Yeah, well, that's the sacrifice that his institute, the end of Local Hero, gets burned down with him as a sacrifice.
Yeah. Totally works.
The long con. Yeah, okay, so, yeah. So this is episode 12 of the podcast, and so in this section of The Wicker Man, we start getting a bit more of the history and folklore for the specific characters of the pagan religion that the Resident of Summerisle follow, with Howie in the library doing his research on the history and celebrations of May Day. And with a particular focus on three characters, the hobby horse, the teaser, and was probably the most important character for later on in the film, Mr. Punch. And it's also at this point where, in the final cut, Howie comes to the realisation that Rowan is still alive. So something that I'll talk about a bit later on in this recording, that in director's cuts, that point happens slightly earlier on, but we'll get to that a bit later. And then after Howie's done his research in the library, he makes his way back to his seaplane that he used to arrive to Summerisle, and finds out that the plane has been sabotaged and he cannot leave the island. And from there, he makes the choice to stay on the island rather than go back to the Scottish mainland and enact his hunt for Rowan directly himself.
I'm always very impressed with, like, just how not panicking he is. 'Cause if that were me in this scenario, I would be freaking... Like, the entire aspect of being stuck on the island now and just knowing... very blatantly knowing that they've sabotaged the plane. There's not really much of a question about it. It's just definitely what's happened. And we'll give it to Howie that he is very cool under pressure in terms of, like, well, I'm still a police officer and I can still go and boss people around, even though drastically outnumbered. Like, he's got zero authority, but he still seems to be acting under the, oh, I'll be fine, because I'm a copper, so who's going to stop me?
And so, yes, before we dive into proper discussion of this section of the film, now, what is your history of the film and your general thoughts on it?
I love this film. This is, I'm trying to remember the first time I saw it. It was one of those ones where, so I grew up obviously reading like Empire magazine and things like that. And I remember that they had like a little booklet one time, came out like early 2000s or very late 90s, which was like a little side booklet that was like, you know, 100 films you must see before you die. And back when, you know, when I was younger, obviously didn't have access to streaming services or the internet in my house, really, like living in not rural Ireland, but like, you know, it wasn't like a cultural hub or anything either. So you just had to depend on what they had in the video shop or what popped up on TV. And if it wasn't there, you just had to wait, basically. And I always remember them having a little section on the Wicker Man in that book. And the image was of Howie waking up in the hand next to the bed. And been like, what? What the hell is this film? You know, like, really fascinated by that. Only to find out in the finished film that's there for like 2 seconds, and it just zooms on past it. I kind of figured that kind of thing was going to be a much bigger part of the finished film. But by the time I got to university, I think I did see it like when I was a teenager. I think it's a very BBC Two, like, Saturday night after like 11:30 kind of film.
Yeah,
that's when it'll appear somewhere. It'll be on BBC Four.
Yeah, like definitely some... BBC Four. Like I've mentioned it earlier on throughout this podcast. Don't know if you watched it, the Mark Gatiss History of Horror series.
Yeah, terrific series. Yeah,
and that's, you know, one of the key factors that got me interested in watching this film for the first time. And It's those kind of things that, you know, see the documentary, and then they'd show some of the horror films that Gatiss featured in there on BBC Four afterwards. It's that kind of film.
Yeah. It's and there's no one has reputation. I think when I went to university, it seemed to get played. They'd do screenings of it on like the uni campus, like shockingly often. Like it was you're never more than like a month or two away from someone somewhere showing The Wicker Man. And it was always weird because I remember one of my lecturers, he kept referring to it as The Wicker Man. He'd always emphasize the man instead of the wicker part. It always weirded me out a little bit. It was like, oh yeah, The Wicker Man. It's like, wait, say it normal. Unless maybe he's like, oh, the man part's the most important part. It's like, the fact that there's a giant guy made of wicker, I think, is the more important element. And yeah, it was one of those things. It was just a sort of beloved film amongst people I knew, too. Like, I've kind of hang out with a lot of people who are, like, big into horror films and stuff. One of the people actually who does the theme music for my show, Batman, it's Ash. He's in a band called Zombina and the Skeletones. And I remember, like, they used to play Halloween gigs every year because they're kind of like a horror-inflected band. And they would do like covers of Willow song and stuff, you know, on the odd occasion. And the weird thing was, though, I actually hadn't seen it for like a long time because I'd just seen it so many times. I was like in my, you know, early 20s. And so this was the first time in like probably about 10 years since I watched it. And I was happy to report, like, oh, still stands up, still terrific, terrific film. It's just so weird because it has the reputation of, it has this sort of ominous vibe about The Wicker Man. It's like, oh, it's one of the most intense, most, you know, acclaimed British horror films of all time.
Yeah, the Citizen Kane of horror.
Yeah. And you watch it and it's like, that's only really the last like 10 minutes that are like the big, big horror element of it.
Yeah, I mean, most of the places kind of like a murder mystery.
So much of a place. Well, I guess so many folk horror things are this basic plot of someone comes to village and turns out the village people ain't right. But it also reminds me like so many episodes of like the old Avengers or something, like, you know, Steed and Peele. Where it would just be like, they go to a quaint little weird village, and it turns out everybody in the town is actually out to get them and stuff.
You see stuff like that in, like, Doctor Who as well.
Oh, totally. Like a proper John Pertwee era Doctor Who could just easily have been a Wicker Man episode, or an episode of Doctor Who could have just been the Wicker Man. And then I guess, like, calls the TARDIS to inside the Wicker Man to save himself or something. I don't know. Yeah, this just really, really stands up really well, too. Got reminded of it last year, actually, because they released that documentary. What's called, like, Woodlands Dark and Days. It was a rare sort of big 3-hour folk horror documentary came out.
Yeah, Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I got to watch that because, weirdly enough, one of my friends is in it. I was like, oh, watch it. And I was like, oh, that's right, The Wicker Man. Yeah, and then they skim past The Wicker Man because they got so much other stuff to talk about. And you're like, oh, this is a really rich and fascinating genre in itself.
And so it's nice that, good that we've got this kind of resurgence in folk horror recently, like, especially with A24. You know, it's probably sound like a broken record throughout this podcast, but you can definitely see A24, their films carrying with the traditions of folk horror. And even, like, recently, like, stuff like last year's Men from Alex Garland.
Definitely.
Obviously, the most obvious ones are Ari Aster films, most obviously Midsommar. But,
yeah. But would you say Midsommar or Midsommar? Because I know some people get very, like, tetchy about it.
Yeah. Well, let's call the whole thing off.
Yeah. Although, actually, I was reminded distinctly of that in this section, because at one point they talk about one of the parts of the old ritual sacrifice being to, like, behead someone and then wear their skin. Wandering around, and I was like, oh, you know, it's weird because they don't like go and like get Howie's. Maybe they do. Maybe they have a crispy Howie cape after the Wicker Man's burnt and go around wearing him. Yeah. But it did remind me in Midsommar
when they escape the altar.
They just go around like wearing his face at one point.
Yeah,
which I was also weird at when I saw in the cinema because like, oh, they do that in that Michael Bay Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake as well. It's weird. So, like, one of the big scares is like, that's from that terrible Texas Chainsaw redo they did a couple of years back. But also, I guess, in fairness to Ari Aster, he's like, I'm taking it from the pagan practice of it's not. I'm not just ripping off Platinum Dunes over here.
Okay? Yeah, I mean, Platinum Dunes have already been ripping off plenty of stuff. So. Even with their remakes, they're still just pretty much ripping most things off anyway.
That was the kind of thing, though, particularly in Midsommar. It was just like, well, see, it sounds a lot like The Wicker Man. And then even going and watching, seeing the ending, it was like, oh, it is. Like it's kind of how like, oh, someone gets burned alive in a fire. That's like, and weirdly too, with the Wicker Man remake, it's like, oh, he's dressed as a bear. That's in that Wicker Man remake as well that they did. But
yeah.
Although I did, oh, in the name of research for this, I did actually watch that as well, the remake, just to see, because I'd seen enough of it over the years to know what the deal was. And then I can verify, having now watched it, it is terrible. Like, outright atrocious. So, you know, the Nick Cage one, hot take, not good.
No. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, another bit of a broken record is pretty much every opportunity that I've taken to trash the Nick Cage remake, I've taken.
It's so bereft of life. Because this one's so enriched by all the folk songs and all like the genuine symbolism, all the stuff, the level of detail they're going to do it even here with Howie like reading like the folklore of the area and stuff. And then they don't have any songs in the Cage version. It just seems like it's boring orchestral score, and it seems to be very much like, yeah, we're kind of half-assed the whole ass of this movie, you know?
Yeah, as I've kind of mentioned before, I consider the original version of The Wicker Man to be a musical.
Yes, yeah. Although the Corn Rings and Barley Rings, that one to me is a bit of a weird song in that, because the rest of them are like, oh, that's proper to old, like, an old folk song you're singing. But that song's so distinctly 1960s. Like, it doesn't sound like it's an old song. It sounds like it's an old song to us, because it's like 50 years old.
Yeah.
But it's when they play that and they're like, oh yes, we wrote new traditional folk songs, like that's the most 1960s sounded song ever heard, man.
But even then, that I mentioned it in the first episode that I recorded when, you know, this song first turned up. That song was actually kind of based on a Robert Burns poem.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it's probably just the way that Paul Giovanni arranged it and how he set that poem to music that created that more distinct 60s, 70s vibe to it. But it's something that really works for me with Giovanni's work in creating that both feel of it being really timeless and fitting the traditions of folklore, but also having it feel distinctly in the time period. It's a whole thing where I don't think you could have made The Wicker Man in this way any other time period than in the early 70s.
Yeah. I think maybe too, like, you'd almost, if you wanted to play like devil's advocate on his behalf, you could say it does sound like a distinctly kind of 60s kind of hippie-ish song in that, like, well, if you wanted to apply a subtext to The Wicker Man, it could be as like, well, it's the encroaching threat of the counterculture on, you know, tradition Christian values and things like that. Considering it's made in 73, like, you already have your post Manson, you know, your post you'd be close to Altamont and all that stuff happening, and you can see like the hippie dream is dying at this point in the culture. So actually having a song, like, it sounds like something that would have been written by like a 60s psychedelic band or something, you know, kind of like a little folk psychedelic band.
Yeah, well, again, it's all those traditions of like that folk music in the 60s, going back on from the traditional folk songs and all. It all kind of feeds back into each other.
There's about to be somebody in Greenwich Village has definitely performed Corn Rigs and Barley Rigs at some point. At some point in the last 50 years, someone's been in there in a coffee shop performing that song. I can guarantee it.
And then you also mentioned, you know, all the research and stuff that was put in with this original. With the remake, the whole thing feels like it's weird for the sake of being weird. You don't feel like there's a purpose to the imagery in the film.
They really try to creepy it up. Like, oh, the blind twins. And you're just like, yeah, whatever. And they always mention the Wicker Man throughout to give it this ominous vibe. And whereas in this movie, it's like, well, the Wicker Man can mean several things. Like, you know, you interpret it as being something beyond the actual physical Wicker Man that's there and stuff.
And then they actually call it by name.
Yeah.
At the ending.
Yeah, it's only, and there's a big moment then was like, oh, your appointment with the Wicker Man. It's like, oh, here we go. But that one, every 10 minutes, they're just like, well, the coming of the Wicker Man. And all this, it's very ham-fisted. And like, ugh. It's so mid-2000s as well. Like, even looking at the posters, it's like, this is dated so terribly. Whereas this movie, actually, like, it is very of its time, but also, you can still go to, like, isolated villages in like the UK or just UK adjacent, and you will at times you do get a Wicker Man vibe. Like, we but like 10 years ago I went on a boat trip, like a self-helmed boat trip up the Shannon River in Ireland. And, you know, this is one of the ones you just rent the boat yourself. It's like a little houseboat, and you just drive it up and stuff. And follow the map, me and a couple of friends. And, like, we'd stop in little sleepy villages that would have, like, the pier was barely hanging on. And you'd go into town and be like, you'd wander in, like, there'd be no one around. You'd wander into, like, a little kind of stone corner shop and be like, can I get a loaf of bread? And, like, oh, you want to be up earlier in the day to get bread, boys. And they just have this real sinister, like, you know, League of Extraordinary, or not League of Extraordinary, League of Gentlemen.
Yeah, kind of going back to Mark Eaters.
And, you know, that kind of thing of, like, and then I remember distinctly getting a real extreme Wicker Man vibe, because I went in to, like, went into the place to get bread. The guy's like, no, you know, you have to be here earlier in the day to get that. And I was like, okay. We went back to the boat, came out like an hour later, went to the pub. The same guy was running the pub. And it was really like, now I'm creeped out. Like, now I'm starting to really panic here. And we were so intimidated, we ended up just staying on the boat the whole night, because we were just like, I saw the Wicker Man. That's all blood on Satan's claw. I know what these people are up to. That may be, you know, that's in Scotland, the Wicker Man. But, you know, it's all the Celtic Isles. It all, you know, it all counts. But yeah. So through that, I would say, like, no, you couldn't make it exactly the way that it's made, but you could really, you know, I think the Wicker Man could still be, well, again, you did kind of do it in midsummer, where it's like, well, maybe just get some fish out of water in a weird place where they don't know what's happening, you know, it still kind of clicks.
Yeah, but even then, with midsummer, it does feel more like a traditional horror film. It doesn't have that unique quality that the Wicker Man has, like the Wicker Man, you've got it as, you know, a murder mystery, it's a musical, it's bit, you know, dark comedy at points.
Yeah.
And it's a horror film. Whilst I think with stuff like Midsummer, that feels more like a horror film first and foremost, with that element of tragedy throughout it. But it doesn't really have that same kind of playfulness that the Wicker Man has.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's a real vibe too. Like Christopher Lee, he went so all in on this film that, like, he's clearly having a great time. Like, every time you see him, he's just like, I'm so excited to be making this and stuff. So he injects a playfulness into it just by seeing how brimming with joy he is that he's getting to make it and stuff. But yeah, we'll do so, like, because I know you'll be covering some of the figures that appear in the book, like the how he's reading, like later in the movie, because they all pop up in like a kind of big bit. This the next like 2 or 3 minutes is just like a flood of foreshadowing.
Yeah, it's all set up for when we get to the procession later on in the film.
Yeah. I did enjoy the particularly now. You see, like, I remember when they did that, you know, the remake of It recently.
Yeah,
and they'd be going through like the town history, and you'd see like drawings of Bill Skarsgård's Pennywise, like, very blatantly, and they're like, oh, it's creepy, because it's the same guy, and stuff, and I admire their restraint when they're showing, like, the sinister teaser, that it's not a guy who looks exactly like Christopher Lee, or something, like, you could have drawn, like, a winking Christopher Lee, just, like, doing the finger guns to Howie through the page, or something, they're like, that's right, buddy, it's all coming in the next half hour or so.
Yeah, I mean, at most, you get that kind of stuff. It's when you see the image of Mr. Punch in the book, and it's pretty much the same costume that Howie ends up wearing later on in the film.
Yeah, yeah. No, I guess they're very strict about their interpretations of Punch in Summer. I was like, no, we just, you know, there's no reboots. We just keep him with the traditional outfit. You know, it's we're not revamping anything. Like, it's the big weird humpback. And the, you know, the long nose and stuff.
It's like the Mr. Punch character is one that's, you know, probably the most well known of the specific characters that's mentioned, you know, in the book. But more for, like, the Punch and Judy shows. And
yeah, it weirded me out. It's like, oh, is this a Punch solo gig? What's this? Like, it's usually a twofer kind of act. It's like, no, Punch has branched out onto his own. This is a solo album, I guess. It's like, he don't need no Judy. But yeah, so odd. You're just like, oh, is this the Punch folklore universe? Where it's like, is it the same Punch from Punch and Judy? He's like, no, Punch is every man, or something like that. But he's Yeah, because the symbolism within Punch is quite rich as well, because he himself is always broken up into like three kind of entities. They mention sort of like it's the king for a day, the fool. What was the exact term they call him? Like the privileged fool, I believe. And I think
the privileged simpleton.
The privileged simpleton. I get to with how he realizes at the end, realizes like, oh, so I was the Punch. Oh, I'm a privileged simpleton. Yeah. Screw you, Summerisle.
Yeah, and there's the whole thing of the residents of Summerisle. They're playing him for the fool.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's really, really terrific. That like, and then I've seen people say that Punch himself is literally supposed to be interpreted like symbolic of the devil as well. It's supposed to be like, is, you know, it's, you know. Yeah, I thought that was, I've seen like people interpret. Yeah, Punch is symbolic of, you know, king for a day, Privileged Simpleton, and the devil. Yeah. I was like, oh, so you're also, it's kind of weird to like spin Howie that way. Is obviously the guy who's so anti-devil. He's the most anti-devil man there. I don't know if you come across that yourself in your research, or
so yeah, having looked at it and you've seen like a lot of the more origins of like the character of Mr. Punch as he's generally known today, like that goes more to Italy and the time of Cromwell and, you know, the theatre traditions that emerged post Cromwell, and it's one where Punch, like, you know, Punch as a children's character, and you know, with the Punch and Judy shows, but then seeing you looking into the history of the characters that did feature, you know, with Punch and Judy shows, and ones include like the Constable and the Devil.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's all kinds of shows how these kind of folk characters that have gone through so many generations and how they've been interpreted and reinterpreted throughout history to the point where like now they're comedy characters. Or even like in other films recently, like did you watch that one Judy and Punch?
Yeah, the Mia Wasikowska movie. Yeah, they kind of spun the whole, let's actually finally concentrate on the inherent sort of misogyny that's in the Punch and Judy show. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and it's all kind of thing which shows how like there's inherent creepiness in those characters, even when they're played for laughs. And yeah, as you mentioned, the misogyny and the kind of more violent nature of the character.
Yeah, yeah. I was weirded out with I don't know if they ever did it intentionally. It might have been a subconscious thing, but like within Father Ted as well, because obviously Father Ted is kind of, it's not kind of Wicker Man vibe, but it does have like odd island town.
Yeah.
Where, and there's religious elements and stuff like that, and just all the locals are weirdos and stuff like that. But they have like the recurring characters of John and Mary, which are like the very happy man and wife couple who run the shop. Yeah. And the joke is that they're actually secretly beating the crap out of each other all the time, and it's all a show. And basically, that's Punch and Judy. Like, it's the same thing. It's just like, oh yeah, you think that, oh yeah, married, the you know, domestic bliss. No, seriously, what's actually happening is that they're clapping each other around the head all the time. And yeah, just it seems like Father Ted's basically remade that in John and Mary. So, but I don't know if they did that deliberately. Or if it was just like, no, just, I guess I kind of just, it's soaked into the subconscious, maybe.
Yeah, it's similar like that. It's those kinds of things have become so synonymous with this kind of vibe that, yeah, even if it's something that you're not doing intentionally, it's those kind of things, the roots of them just come out kind of no matter what.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Also got, so a lot of stuff with Punch, and then another thing though that like I thought like in the remake, because they have him be a bear, which I guess is supposed to be more like, well, because they've got a whole thing in that movie about it being is the Summer Isle's ruled by women, and I guess the bear is supposed to be more of a symbol for like masculinity or something, or it just feels really weird that they had like, well, it's such a good, just clear cut kind of symbolic thing that like, yeah, the guy's come, he's been played for the fool, so he ends up dressing as the fool. Like, that's, why would you mess with that? Like, it was right there for you. But, Of course, then when he does go up, not to jump ahead too much, but when he goes up and punches somebody in the face, and you're like, there you go, classic punch. He did the thing, at least. Like, at least when he was in the outfit.
I mean, you can imagine someone doing it now, having it, how we say, like, that's the way to do it after doing that punch.
I was weird at it just within the scene, though, in general, because you have, and I'm assuming they just do this just to break up, like, the kind of monotony of, you know, a guy reading, basically. Because it's all internal monologue in Edward Woodward's head. And then he kind of comes to a small revelation. Then this old lady looks at him as if she knows what he's thinking. Like, and it kind of, like, it's a weird, like, I know you can hear my thoughts, boy. Meow, 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 meow. Like, the thing is, I know how he's the hero. And I know there's been a lot of debate. Like, oh, it's kind of weird that they make him such an unlikable character, even though he's kind of... But I found it unforgivable, quite frankly. That he just, like, starts reading out the text aloud. To kind of, like, just do... Like, you're in the library, man. You're not supposed to do that. You're all about law and order. You know that you don't talk out loud in the library. You're supposed to... It's notorious for the shushing. What are you doing? But I guess maybe he's had it up to here with the somewhere else. He's like, I'll talk wherever the hell I want to talk.
Yeah, this whole thing where it's... I think interesting how that's how he in this scene. It's the only really things that he where it's like seeing how we read it, and because this is actually probably the first time in the film that how he's actually made an effort to look into the culture and the religion. Throughout the rest of the film, he's just taken a philosophical stance against the religion. No matter what, there's no way that he finds that it's in any way worth considering it as a valid religion because it goes so against his Christian values. And it's only really at this point when he starts to show that due diligence of actually paying attention to the religion itself.
Yeah, yeah. It's so odd, though, actually, in the portrayal of him as a character, because like what do you like make of Howie? Like, do you like him as a character? Like, not obviously Edward Woodward is doing a fantastic job of playing him, but just as a person, because he's so, it's weird. Maybe now because we're in more of a hedonistic heathenous age, because he's so pious and self righteous and he's so conform to Christian values. He seems like it, to me he's a bit of like, I don't really like this guy. Fair play to him, because he's really, really dedicated to finding Rowan. But that's about the only good thing he's got going for him in my eyes. And he's so judgmental of the Islanders. Where, for the most part, it's kind of like, loosen up, man. Like, what, you don't have to be a dick about everything. It's only really at the end, when they're actively sacrificing him, that I'm like, well, I guess maybe he had a point about them.
So one thing I mentioned in a few episodes ago, when we had that conversation between Lord Summerisle and Howie, and how in that scene and really throughout the film, it's Summerisle who feels like the more nuanced, more respectful character. And
oh, totally.
100%. You see how he just blusters his way in and just his way is right because he represents the Christian morals of the time.
Yeah.
And anyone who doesn't conform with Howie's rigid ideals of what morality is, it's no matter how good they appear to be, that Howie's inherently against them. And it does all create the vibe of Howie being this, well, for lack of a better term, he's a bit of a dick throughout the film.
Yeah. But even here in this scene where he's just like, oh God, even these people can't be that mad. They're just saying it to like a little old lady who lives there. It's like, shut up, man. What are you doing? But I do enjoy though the opposite ends of the spectrum though. It kind of puts the characters all the characters at, because Howie is like one thing is like, he's so rigid and he's so buttoned down and so repressed, and it kind of seems like it's not really like, I don't know how much he's getting out of life by being so. What joy does he have? Like, he's just self-righteousness, piousness? Is this what's sustaining him? But at the end of the day, he's a good guy, because at least he's trying to save a life and stuff. He's, he's going in trying to help a little girl. Whereas the Islanders are so much on the other end of the spectrum, where it's all joy. And they're all just, like, free love. Everyone's just going out having a good time, singing songs, all, sea shanties and just dancing. And, like, hey, we're just having a wonderful, wonderful time. And this island is supposed to be blossoming with beautiful fruit and stuff, but they are inherently also evil because they don't have a problem with just like, yeah, we'll just kill this guy because why not? Like, we're going to get something out of it, so screw him. Have you read Ritual as well? The original book?
Yeah, that's something where I was trying to read it before wanting to did this podcast, but it's kind of one where it's not really something I was able to properly get a copy in time before. So that's it. I mean, even looking on Amazon, like I'm looking on Amazon right now for it, and it's actually one that's can be pretty hard to find.
Yeah, yeah. That'd be terrible. And you had the you buy it, but it's like it's one of those movie based on the book editions. That's just like Nick Cage on the cover. It's like Ritual, also known as The Wicker Man.
Yeah.
And that's the only one I've got. Like, I don't want people to see me reading this. God damn it. You can't go out to Costa for anything. He's like, no. I can't be seen reading reading a copy of The Wicker Man with Nick Cage on the cover, for the love of God. But I don't know from I've not read it myself. But I know that people have said that it's very emphasized within the text. That's Morris Samael himself is like fully aware of how kind of like nonsensical like traditions are. And he knows that, like, I think it is in the movie, but it's like, it's apparently it's more emphasized in the book that, like, no, the reason the island is so fruitful is because of his grandfather's experiments with fruit strains and stuff. And so he's like, he knows, like, oh, it's just, that scientific strain, just whatever, I'll have to work something out to fix that. But in the meantime, to keep the plebs happy, I'm just letting them do this. Which makes him much more malignant. Because it's kind of like, well, I guess he is, in the movie, kind of comes across a lot more. He's like, well, he's looking out for his people, I guess. Like, and then this kind of asshole-ish, prudish cop comes in, bossing everyone around, knocking out the punch guy and stuff.
Yeah.
Sacrifice him, still obviously inherently evil, but just kind of like, well, he's just like, this is what we need to do. But to know then that within the text originally, it was just like, no, I know that this is all, that won't fix anything, but I've got to keep the wolves away from the door kind of thing. So yeah, I'm just making this up as I go. Like, it's like, we'll get a guy, go find me like a prudish virgin police officer.
Yeah.
And we'll just kill him.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I'm probably going to talk about later on as well when we actually get to the explanation of what's going to happen to Howie.
Mm-hmm.
Is the question of, in Lee's performance, how much of it does Sorrel actually believe in? And as I said, it's clear that it starts out as a means to an end, but
yeah,
it's how much has Lord Sorrel actually grown to believe the religion himself, or versus how much of it is he using it as in the same way his grandfather did.
Yeah. I think it's a good one, straight from like, the assigned minutes or anything, but I think there's a really terrific scene at the end though, how he pointed out to him, was like, well, if this doesn't work, they're gonna come for you next year.
And it's that look on Lee's face.
Yeah. That. Because he knows, you got me there. But it's a movie I'd never want to see a sequel. But I also am very curious to wonder, like, did it work? Like, what happened to Summer Isle after? Did it happen to make a good harvest the next year? And they're like, oh, phew, that was a close one there for me for a second. Or what happened? But I guess maybe the power in it is not knowing whether it all paid off or not.
Yeah, and you've got that pseudo sequel with the Wicker Tree.
Yeah, yeah.
And there were plans for an actual proper sequel, like, and made up, and like scripts and stories in there. Like, I've got the book Inside the Wicker Man, and that goes into detail on what the proposed direct sequel would have been.
Mm.
And I'm probably going to save it more for the final episode to actually go into detail of what that proposed sequel would have been, but all I see right now is it's pretty wild.
No, I'll have to look it up. I'm just hoping that it's not like it cuts to 6 months later and it's Christopher Lee in a bar seducing James Franco and trying to get him to come back to the islands, and then it just echoes and Edward Woodward screams over the top of everything. Unless that is what it is, I've just ruined your future episode for you. God damn.
I mean, obviously the true sequel is how he ends up surviving, becomes a doctor instead of a police officer, moves to Stamford, Gloucestershire, and starts the Neighbourhood Watch Alliance.
Yeah, there you go. I'm not too sure if I can verify entirely, but But I did look into seeing if I could identify who the old lady in the library is. And I think it's a woman called Mabel Etherington. She's credited as basically like old woman, like old lady parishioner, brackets uncredited. Nearly everything in her IMDb is uncredited. But I'm assuming unless you have any other verification that like old lady parishioner is a completely different character elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, it's one where it does kind of fit this one. Like it's one where, you know, you're just looking on IMDb, there's like no pictures, so
yeah.
It's the one that can be easily verified.
It's kind of weird, it's like, yeah, she's been in like 83 things, but all of it's uncredited work. It's all uncredited extra work, so it's like, I guess maybe she just worked for an extras agency, or maybe she knew someone who worked on every one of these movies. Yeah. I'm like, come on down and be in it, or whatever. Yeah. But
and I mean, I've got her IMDb up right now, and the first thing that comes up is, well, going with Christopher Lee, he's a long-time Hammer co-star. Mabel Atherton was in the adaptation of Pride and Prejudice, where Peter Cushing played Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, there you go.
It's all wrong, so.
Yeah. The thing that really stuck out to me is that, because I always will link things back to Batman, as is my way just to plug the show, you know? but apparently she's also in Trog, which is the sort of infamous Joan Crawford at her lowest ebb, where she made this like atrocious horror movie where she like basically had to look after a caveman troglodyte. And it was sort of like a, you know, big, like it's a very campy, like low budget British horror goof fest, basically. And it's very, very silly, regardless of one of the worst films ever made. But it also then has the added cadence of like, but Joan Crawford's in it. And she's like, she's delivering, like she's there, like properly doing the work. But also stars Michael Goff, of course, is Tim Burton's Alfred in the lab. So I was like, oh, Trog always has a place in my heart, just because Alfred or Michael Goff is in it. So also weird thing, because we have, of course, this season doing Mask of the Phantasm, which is the animated Batman movie that was, you know, spinoff from the animated series with, you know, Kevin Conroy's Batman, Mark Hamill's Joker, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know if you're aware, but apparently Christopher Lee was courted to be in the show. Couldn't do it because of he was just living in England at the time. Yeah. And, you know, nowadays I'd be like, well, just do it over the phone. What's the problem? But I guess back in the 90s, it was much more of a problem. I was like, well, we can't.
I mean, thinking of characters, I have the feeling he would have been courted for Ra's al Ghul.
Yep, that's exactly who they're looking for.
Yeah. I mean, as good as Christopher Lee would have been, I don't think anyone could beat David Warner as that character.
Yeah, they really landed on their feet with that. Because I think they were going for... They asked Christopher Lee first, and apparently he really wanted to do it. He was like, no, and you can see why, because it's like... It actually would have a kind of weird vein back into The Wicker Man. Well, Ra's al Ghul is a leader of a kind of a religious cult, and they have their also beliefs in other gods and other all these kind of things. And he's the big, you know, the charismatic, domineering guy, you know, calling the shots for everyone. It's like it's very Lord, you know, Lord Summerisle. So I'm sure they're more like, well, Cape Dracula, it's Christopher Lee, why wouldn't you get him to play the part? But it would have a weird sort of like intertextual callback. They're like, we played a guy very similar to this. But I think, yeah, they went to him, he couldn't do it. And then they went to Michael York, who actually is in the show as like a one-off character. I guess maybe he could just make it for that one. And then they landed on David Warner, and then they're just like, oh, thank God. Because like, it turns out he was the best guy for the job, really. So synonymous with that now that anytime I've been reading Ra's al Ghul in comics, it's like, well, the voice just goes into your head instantly. It's so, you know, in sync with what they needed. But yeah, I can tell you, the thing is that knowing Tim Burton, though, is such a big Christopher Lee fan. This is always a shame that, like, he never got to, you know, go on. If he had continued making Batman movies, you could have had a Batman sequel with Ra's al Ghul and Christopher Lee just playing the part in live action, like back in the 90s. That's the thing I would totally.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it's everyone where he would have done, again, even as I said, as good as Christopher Lee probably would have been. And even like my introduction to the character being Liam Neeson in the Nolan films. Yeah. No matter whenever I read anything or scripts or other comics with that character, the voice in my head is always David Warner now.
Yeah. Yeah. But they knew what they're doing with the casting on that show. Because most of the time, too, when you read Batman, it's always Kevin Conroy's voice that pops into your head. A lot of times when you read the Joker, it's like, well, Mark Hamill's really left a mark on that character. David Warner just did exactly the same thing. But although I think back in the 90s, they probably wouldn't have been ready for... They needed to keep mining the very well-known villains of, like, the Riddler and stuff like that. Because, like, mid-1994, and just Ra's al Ghul appearing as Christopher Lee. They'd be like, what? What the hell's happening? Like, I don't know. I've never heard of this guy before, but, well, you never know. But I'm sure there's an alternate reality out there somewhere where that came to pass. But we'll never know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and then actually, then just going back into like this scene in particular, there's actually an interesting point with the editing of the point with which Howie recognizes that and realizes that Rowan is still alive. Because in the director's cut, Howie comes to this realization slightly earlier on, before you know his seduction by Willow when he. After he's broken into the pharmacy and gone through the pictures and realised that you know, Rowan was the symbol of the May Day the previous year when the harvest failed. And it's kind of at that point that Howie realises that Rowan is alive and intends to be a sacrifice.
Rowan's not dead!
Yeah, but it's an instance where I prefer the way it's done in here in the final cut.
Hmm.
And with Howie coming to this realization after he's done the research and read up about what the history of the island's religion and the nature of their sacrifices and that they would do a human sacrifice after years of poor harvest. And it makes more sense to me it being done at this point in the film rather than slightly after he's... looked at the photographs because at that point he doesn't fully understand what the actual nature of the sacrifice would be.
Yeah, yeah. No, it makes much more sense to have it here. Yeah, 100%. I definitely agree with that. It's very clear-cut. It's not quite spoon-feeding filmmaking, but, like, I don't know if I needed the flash of Rowan's face. Like, him just internally saying Rowan's not dead would have been... But it almost feels like we might put up a picture so people remember who Rowan is. It's like, we've been looking for Rowan the whole damn movie. Like, we don't need to know this, but we don't need that reminder. But
yeah, although there's nothing where I think... I mentioned it when he actually covered that scene earlier on in this podcast, but when Howie has that realization in the director's cut in the pharmacy, they actually do flashbacks to minutes, like a minute or two earlier, when Howie's does his second visit to Lord Samrail's manor.
Yeah.
And it's nothing where it feels like in the director's cut they do a bit too much there. They didn't need to have the flashback here, and it's just that they've got it's and even here it's just a little flasher, but it works better rather than just having a full flashback.
I don't know in the director's cut they're like, people are really having trouble following what is a very simple story. We need to constantly remind them of what's going on at every given moment. Flashback to the literally the previous scene.
Again, it's another reasons why whenever I watch The Wicker Man, it's the final cut that I go for.
Yeah. I think it's like the default one as far as I think now if you find it on streaming services, this is the version you'll get. These days, as far as I'm aware, it was the one I found anyway. So
yeah, well, it's actually interesting because I think that's what it is in the UK. I've had a few guests from America on, and when they've watched it on stuff like Shudder over in America, the version that's most common for them is the theatrical cut, not the final cut, and that's probably going to change this year. You know, we've got the 50th anniversary and. The upcoming 4K remaster of the film.
Is it? Well, I don't know. Maybe the real sticklers over there. Like, no. But maybe they're so traditional themselves. It's like, we stick with the old way. The old cuts survive.
Yeah.
So we'll watch. Yeah, we'll watch their like worse edited version of the movie. We don't care. It's what our children were raised on.
Yeah, again, it's somewhere because of all the stuff that was cut out of the theatrical version. Whenever I do my rewatches, that's not the one I watched. Like, I was more familiar with the director's cut when I first watched it, and then my go-to one is now the final cut.
Yeah. Oh, totally. It's like every time they call it the final cut, and I was like, but, you know, all of them were deceived, for there was another cut. And they pay Robin Hardy comes out like, actually, no, this one's the one I really want. Yeah. I wanted Edward Woodward going, no! As he's in, is it going up to the Wicker Man.
How he shoots first.
Yeah. We had to add in more CGI people wandering around, a couple like doobacks in the background and stuff there.
Yeah, they needed to add more walkie-talkies in there.
I will say, though, I don't know why I love it so much, but as we do transition then to like the next scene, I just really love the edit of him slamming the book. I find it kind of weirdly funny for some reason. So he's had this big revelation, and it cuts to this wide shot of him, the little old woman, still just staring at him, and then like slamming this book with a real, like, meh. Like, I don't know what it is, but for some reason it really tickles me. But because he could have just done a straight cut to him going to the plane, but no, they made the choice to put them his book slam of frustration.
Yeah.
I don't know if that will. I don't think she is the librarian herself, but. It's a man in for a shushing. I gotta tell, you know, first he's talking, then he's slamming books shut. Like, come on, man. If the library policeman was there, you know, you might have like a Lieutenant Bookman show up.
Just get Conan the librarian in there.
But I know there's a lot of other stuff in that book about like this, the pentangle of swords and the hobby horse and stuff like that. But this is all stuff you'll be, having to talk about a lot more when you actually see the genuine ones later on in the movie. So
I'm actually getting, I just feel like when we actually get to the procession itself and we see their function in full effect as part of the celebrations, it's better to have it at the discussion at that point.
It cut down to him going down to the plane. There's some random cows in the background there. There's some real flashbacks of back home, I have to say. Just the random cattle just strewn around the place. And so when was the last time I was back in Ireland, I was just like walking down the street. It's like, oh, there's a donkey. There's a donkey just walking along the street. everything I have to say, though, I don't think it ever really dawned on me. In previous viewings, they're like, oh yeah, how he's driving that plane himself. Like, yeah. It's just like, so when they were tracking down to try to find the guy, like, would someone suitable, like, did they have all the criteria written out of, like, we need a guy, like, a fully adult person, virgin, essential. If they have a pilot's license, it would be really, really handy, because... Otherwise, we're going to have to deal with, like, a ferry system, I guess, maybe, or, like, something coming in on a boat, and apparently that takes a week.
Yeah.
So, we've managed to come back, and then, like, whatever way they found him. Been like, no, we found, like, a really pious asshole police officer who's a virgin.
Who's a qualified pilot.
Yeah, he's got a qualified pilot, so he can bring in, you know, official the plane, and then just go and fiddle with the engine, and then we're set. This is Christopher Lee or something. Oh, fantastic. I do love this whole, because this is start when the screws really, really start to tighten. Within this scene. And it's, you know, throughout you're always aware that, like, particularly on rewatches, that the entire village is aware of what's happening and they're kind of like, you know, sniggering behind his back in a weird way. But this one, it takes a much more sinister, like, outright sinister turn.
Yeah. And it works well as a bit of a contrast with how he first arrives on Summer Island, the residents of the island, they come and do that greeting at the dock. Mm. And, you know, it's kind of that more informal, just feels more kind of natural that it's a group of people who actually be curious seeing this, who's arriving on a seaplane. And here, when we see the residents looking at Howie with the animal masks on, which are parts of their celebration for May Day, and it's that lack of features on them, it's unsettling.
Yeah, yeah. I was wondering actually if, because it is so naturally unsettling, like, I was wondering if it had, you know, they did that movie like 10 years ago, You're Next.
Yeah.
And they were also wearing kind of animal masks. I was wondering if it, in any way, if they were taking influence from The Wicker Man. This is like, well, it is very unsettling, and just that, like, because a lot of them too are children as well.
Yeah.
It even makes it even more kind of, and just wondering what the mentality of wearing the masks all day is like, because I think a lot of the, I don't think they never mention Beltane outright in the movie. Like that's, you know, part of the sort of Celtic, you know, pagan celebrations. It was like, well, the beginning of summer is Beltane, and then obviously you have Samhain at the end,
yeah,
which is, you know, Halloween. And it was just like, so them going around wearing animal masks and stuff, you know, a lot of the stuff within Samhain, as people be aware, it's like the people dressing up as, you know, demons and witches and things like that, it's because believe that the reality is thinned so that the actual entities from the afterlife, or, you know, the other world and stuff, will be just roaming the land. And if you're wearing an outfit, they might mistake you for one of theirs and leave you alone, kind of thing. I'm just wondering if that's supposed to be the mentality of what they're doing here. But then there's also all the stuff too about, like, everything always about joining with something else. So you had, like, you know, the sinister teasers, like the man and woman joined together, the hobby horse, it's a man and animal together, and then there's like the man fool and things like that. So, well, you know, trying to theorize like what the mentality of the summer islanders, like, by like dressing as animals all day, like, are they worried that some animal spirits are wandering around that they want to sort of blend in with, or they're just like, we just really like dressing up, man. It's just great fun wearing these masks.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like for this bit in particular, there feels like they're doing it to kind of deliberately mess with Howie.
If he eventually does call someone, I'm like, well, you know, you were there, and you were there, and you were there. He's like, no, it's like, I recognize your orange jumper. I don't, you can wear that mask. I still know it was you, you little dick. Yeah. Although we're going to get like other police officers too. It's just like to come to arrest the entire island.
Yeah.
Like, what's the mentality here? But I don't know if I respect or I completely disrespect his complete faith in, like, still being a police officer, still 100% believing that he's going to get the situation sorted.
Yeah.
And he can just sort of, you know, come in, swing his truncheon around, and everyone's gonna fall into place. Because even like when he's rowed out to the plane, gets in, and then the way he calls the guy back is so rude as well. Like, anyone else would be like, oh, sorry, yeah, could you come back? But he's like, hey, you, come here, come back. Yeah. Here. Like, he's so aggressive with everybody. Yeah. It's a real, like, you know, again, too, the thing is, the guy rowing the boat could be like, well, screw you, man. I'll leave you out there then. Like, where do you think you're getting off? Coming in, barking orders at me.
Yeah.
You're the one who's at a disadvantage here. But that's just, his whole thing is that, like, he's always, from the second he steps off the plane at the start, he's always at a disadvantage, but he always seems to have, whether you want to interpret that as another sort of layer to, you know, the ideas of faith within the movie, but his faith in being like, well, I think this uniform is symbolic, and my position entitles me to this, and I have complete faith in being a police officer will make people obey me and stuff. Even the point that, like, he makes a point of putting his hat back on when the guy's coming back, as if, like, I need to be in the full uniform all the time. You know, it's all symbolic and stuff.
Yeah, and this whole thing where I've mentioned it other times, where aside from when Howie's in his bedroom and when he's dressed for the Wicker Man, he's always in uniform.
Yeah, that's right too. Yeah, again, in the library, didn't take his hat off. You know, usually when you're indoors, people always make you take your hat off. But he did. I don't know. He makes his own rules, I guess. I know you won't get that scene yet, but please do cover the fact. I'm assuming maybe because the whiskey they gave him was drugged. It always really bugged me that despite the tense situation, he falls asleep with the door wide open. Like, yeah. It really, really bothered me. Like, I can't do that at all. That always used to bother me in, like, the Paranormal Activity movies, too, where they're really panicked. The house was haunted. Let's just leave the door lying wide open when we go to bed. Like, what the hell are you doing? Shut everything down. But, yeah, even with all this, he goes to bed, and he's just like, yeah, just leave the door hanging open there. What's going to happen? Dude, you're a cop. Anything can happen.
Yeah, we'll cover that bit when we get to that later on.
Yeah, sorry. I keep drifting off from the assignment here, so my apologies.
Yeah, no worries. It's always interesting hearing these the directions these conversations take.
That's a personal pet peeve of mine. This is really, like, I don't know the mentality. So I know people who do it in real life, too. And I don't understand them either, but... But yeah, you got another little bit of sort of pagan symbolism as well. Because on the boat, they do pause to emphasize this eye painted on it.
And again, as I mentioned in episode 2, and interesting what you think about it, hearing it, knowing it, is that eye was actually something from a resident of the village of Plockton where these scenes were filmed. It was something that was already there. It wasn't something that was created specifically for the film.
Oh, wow. Did they get into why this person painted an eye on their boat? Or?
I don't think that's ever really known, but it works so well establishing that from the moment that Howie's plane lands at Summerisle, he's being watched.
Yeah. It's good, like, because you can interpret it as being like, oh, it's like the Eye of Providence. It's another pagan symbol in terms of, like, you know, things like that where they're... Because the Eye of Providence is, like, it's sort of held as, like, a pagan symbol of, like, oh, we're more enlightened because we're seeing beyond and things like that. But also just serves the very simple purpose of, like, well, he's been watched all the time. Like, even, you know, even when he's on the boat, he's getting watched everywhere he went. There's somebody keeping tabs on him. Like, it's terrifying. Like, it's really... Again, this is the part of the movie, like, I'm really stunned he's not panicking more, because this is when it starts to really, the creep factor really, really starts to amp up.
Yeah, it feels like at this point, it's his anger's overriding his panic.
Yeah. We're very different men, me and Howie, because I would be like, when he's like, oh, I'll take a week to row to shore, like, fine. just get me off this goddamn island.
Yeah.
I need to get away from here, man.
Yeah, and it's often where even at this point, even after they've deliberately sabotaged the plane to keep him on the island, it's still Howie's own choice that he stays there. I mean, he's given the option of leaving then, even though it would take a week, or just staying with the plane and trying to get a mechanic or not really do anything. He makes the choice to go back onto the island and search for Rowan himself.
And then again, too, like, what was he planning to do? It's like, literally everybody there is against you, man. Like, what are you going to do? How are you going to get out of there? But also, no, too, not to bring it up again, but, like, in its mid-2000s horror movie way, the remake has to amp things up at this point. Because it wasn't Nick Cage who drove himself. He didn't fly the plane to the island. It was some guy. Yeah. And, of course, he finds his body... They've killed him, and I think they've gouged his eyes out and sewn his mouth shut or something. Yeah. There's some weird kind of thing going on. And it's just so... This scene, as presented here, is so sinister just by the way the guy's, like, laughing at him and stuff, and the whole thing of just like, oh, you want to go on Mayday? I better take you out myself. Oh, is there something wrong? Like, the children did that, though. I couldn't, you know... Yeah. Knowing that he's lying, and then knowing that all these people are watching him.
Yeah, it's the kind of less is more approach with... The original, you don't need those bits from the remake. That just kind of, if anything, it just takes away from the horror and adds to the unintentional comedy that the film has.
Yeah, oh no, that's like again, not to get into it, but like so much of that movie is very unintentionally funny, like, but so shoddily done. They're like, how did they not know that people would laugh at this?
Yeah, well, even here, even like getting to the end of this section with. You have a little bit so where it's deliberately farcical and comic, like when Howie follows the hobby horse to the meeting of the residents of Summerisle. And, you know, it's a ridiculous looking thing, this hobby horse. And they kind of know it's ridiculous, but they play it in a way that it still has this unsettling quality to it.
I think it's because it's deliberately leading him.
Yeah.
It's doing the little click, you know, click, click. And that's
to grab his attention, and you hear the bells on it.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it's becoming much more apparent that it's a very blatant manipulation. And this guy's been sent out like, well, you go get him and then make sure that he follows you in through these little inroads and stuff and back alleys and things like that so we can get him the way we need to get him. It is funny just because the prop itself is sort of like a little farcical looking, but again, I felt this was this genuinely unnerved me, because you're just like, even though I don't really like him as a person, I'm just like, dude, get out of there, just go. There's whatever you need to do to get off the island. Go hide somewhere for a couple of days or something. That'll do. But like,
I'll just stay with the plane and wait until after everything, because
I suppose if he waited to May 2nd. Would they be like, nah, okay, here's it, we'll send the guy to fix your engine, you can go now, because we missed it. I actually don't know. Like, yeah, I guess maybe he should have just waited them out. I suppose he didn't know. Yeah.
But again, that's for us, with the benefit of hindsight, for what actual nature of the film was. And...
Yeah, true. Yeah, he is trying to do the right thing. He's trying to track down a little girl, so that's fair enough.
Yeah.
But then, of course, you get the glorious debut, though, of... one of the main characters, one of the most iconic characters of the movie, Christopher Lee's mustard jumper.
Yeah.
Which is just seared into my brain cells from the first time I saw pictures of it. I was like, ooh.
Yeah, I mean, if there's anyone who can carry off that color, it's Christopher Lee.
Oh, totally. Totally. Like, this man wear anything. And also, too, he's like, what, 7 foot or something? That's what else. I was like, are you going to question him? The guy wants to wear a freaking eye-searing
yellow
jumper.
He's incredibly tall and was in the SAS. Well, actually, I don't think the SAS. It was officially called the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare.
I guess such the vibe, though, that he was so used to being like, well, I'm always put in suits and in capes and always drab colors. But he's just so excited to make this. He's like, yes, the brightest outfit ever. Just get me that. And they put like a hideous tweed jacket on top of it. And sure, yeah, I'll dance it. I love, too, you see that he's wearing sneakers and stuff as well. It's so not the image of Christopher Lee you usually get, but he suits it so well.
And these and you see him doing practicing his dancing. It's and the way everyone in like that little courtyard are acting, it feels fun. It feels like a traditional kind of playful May Day celebration.
Yeah. Again, it does have the big tragedy of Summer Isle. It's like, well, if it wasn't for the murder. You know, everything else about it is great. Even going out, it's like, yeah, people just randomly shagging outside pubs. Like, that's just the way it goes, I guess. But everything about it seems like, well, they're having much, their lives seem so much better than Howie's. And yet, you know, their one big downfall is like, well, if it was, I would have bought into it if it wasn't for those pesky murderers.
It's a weird thing where all it takes is one murder and you're thrown off a place.
This is the point too now where, so I think the only thing about the Wicker Man is it doesn't start off slow, but I guess unless you, I think when I first saw it, I was already aware of how it was going to end. I think it was one of those things that was like, so the ending was so wildly reported that I kind of knew enough to already keep me hooked. When you first watched, did you know where it was going, or were you just like as oblivious as Howie?
For me, when I first watched it, I'd watched it after having that ending said into me. Like, I mentioned, the Mark Gatiss documentary, or those countdown lists that Channel 4 did.
But I'll be very curious, like, or maybe you've had people on already who were oblivious to it, because I think it's around this scene where, like, you think people are going to be in now, because you have to see what happens. Whereas at the beginning, I can imagine it could be some people mightn't be interested, because they're just like, what's this sort of a guy wandering around? Like, I don't really know why should I stick with this? I think I always did, because I always knew where it was going. But have you had on people who weren't aware of, like, what was their first time, or they're completely oblivious to the film?
I have had a few people on where it's their first time, or they've not had the same kind of history as being as familiar with The Wicker Man, but or where if they were familiar with it, it was more through the remake first rather than this original one. And it's always been interesting hearing with how they react to the film and whether how they've seen it going, and also which version they watched in the first instance.
It'd be weird though, yeah, people coming in going like, there wasn't even any bees in it. Like, well, that's what I know about The Wicker Man, is the bees.
Yeah, and even that bit was in the theatrical cut of the remake.
Oh yeah, that's the deeper knife cut is that you're like, this film is awful, but at least I'll get to that bees meme. Not even in the movie. You have to go and watch it on YouTube after to get your fix. So, god damn it, this is like it couldn't. Just when you think it couldn't get worse, somehow they made.
Yeah. So is there any other things you want to talk about with the film in general or this specific section of it?
No. I think that's me. Again, just thanks for having me on. Because it was just a joy to be able to revisit The Wicker Man. I hadn't seen it in so long, and it's just such a great. It's got such a great vibe of a film.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so, it's weird again that, like, if it wasn't for the murdering at the end, it's so pleasant sitting around somewhere else. Like, it's just, like, I love the music so much. I kind of love the vibe of the people. You know, I would say, except for when they're picking on Howie, but also, like, you know, I get it. Like, I try to knock this guy down a peg or two myself. But, it's weird that it's a pleasure to watch, but also, like, I guess it shouldn't be, because, like, well, these people are supposed to be evil as well, but,
But it's what makes it such a compelling film to watch, is it being a slow burn rather than it being immediate.
I'm very happy to come on and talk. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for agreeing to be on, and, to everyone listening, thanks for listening to it. So, yeah, before we end, do you have anything that you want to plug?
Yeah. I have two shows out currently. One is a podcast called Miami Minutes, where me and my co-host John are breaking down the 1987 craptacular kung fu classic Miami Connection, 1 minute at a time. It releases one episode a week. And that's just the two of us just kind of dicking around. It's a very, very relaxed affair, because it's a ridiculous film. So it's just fun to riff on. And then my main project is Batman, which is, you know, mentioned several times throughout the episode. We're breaking down the Batman films 1 minute at a time. And that one's much more well-researched and much more in-depth. Like, we actually probably dive into, you know, the comics history and the actor's history and all that kind of stuff. We really dissected those Batman films. There's four completed seasons at the moment, so that's starting from 89. So the Keaton movies, then Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, all done to completion. And currently, as this episode comes out, we'll be knee deep in Mask of the Phantasm, which was, people often forget, which it was a theatrically released animated Batman film from 1993. And it's regarded as being, if not one of the best, then the best Batman film. I wouldn't go that far myself, but it is very, very good. And it's a nice tonic, because we did spend like a year talking about every minute of Batman and Robin. So it's kind of nice to be able to go back into something where it's like, oh, here we go. This is the way you make a film. that's all available. You can find Miami Minutes. It's just, if you just Google Miami Minutes, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, at the Taekwondo orphanage over there. And then Batman, this is like, if you Google Batman, we're also on Twitter. Instagram is the Batman, and then we have the Batman Listeners Cave on Facebook, where you just come on and talk about anything you want that's tangentially Batman related. We've had a whole big thing this season too, because we've been dissecting people's, because the animated series is such a sort of big part of many people's childhoods. We've been talking about a lot of other childhood favorite cartoons and stuff. So there's a lot of that going on in the listener's cave currently. So if you want to hear people debate which was the best theme tune to Gem and the Holograms, that's the place to go.
And you can say, yeah, thanks for that. And then for me, my general plugs, outside of this podcast, you find my main view site over at coogsreviews.wordpress.com. And then my Twitter feed at Tony Coogs, and Instagram Kogan Tony. Now I'd like to thank you again for taking part in this podcast.
Oh, thank you again for having me.
And to everyone listening, I'll speak to you again next week.